Welcome to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. In a world where talking about the impact of money is difficult, we share stories and tips for reducing the negative impact that significant wealth can have on our emotions, relationships, and behaviors. Now here's your host, Ginny Galisonow.
Welcome, everyone. Today we have with us a gentleman whose family has the good fortune to live between Australia and Aspen. We first came to know each other when you and your wife attended one of my seminars, and subsequently, you asked me to guide your family through its very first family retreat in order to begin talking with your sons about the meaning and impact of the family's wealth. Thank you for being with us today and for your willingness to be so vulnerable as to share your story with all of us. Share with us a little bit about who you are, how you got started, and where you are today.
First things is, I never started life thinking about wealth or money. Whatever I've done, whatever I'm doing today, is about challenges and problems and solving problems. And if in the course you do good, then you're rewarded about it. So it's not, I never set out to say, I want to make a million or 100 million or whatever. It just, if you do good things happen to you. And they've happened to me and my family.
So did you grow up with an entrepreneurial spirit?
When I reflect back on it, I probably did. I grew up as a kid in Florida. My parents were not wealthy at all. In fact, not even close to it. My father, he was in World War II. And like most people coming out of the war, you just got jobs. But he almost always worked for himself or for other people in the furniture and furnishings business. And he would get bored very quickly. He might set a business up, and after 18 months, he'd leave and join something else or do something else. Never made any money out of it, but my mother supported him. My mother also brought me up when I'd say, oh, why can't I do this or that because they're doing it? And she said, why do you care what other people are doing? You should do what you want to do and what you think is right. And I think that's been with me my whole life, that I don't have to live up to other people's expectations, that I set my own goals, and whether I work for myself or not. And I think before I started off on my own journey, I was very fortunate to be in a company in the headquarters. My background's geology and mining, and I was in the headquarters of a large mining company, and I was in a very small group doing some, in the 70s, very innovative things with computers around mining and technology, and I loved it. I loved the challenge of doing new things, not same thing over and over and over again. So when I went out on my own, it was not a big fear. I didn't fear failure. I didn't have those, it was just something that I did, and I just enjoyed and solving problems for other people. And then when it was my chance to set up my own company, or in partnership, a listed company, we resurrected a company that was suspended from trading and $1 million in debt and turned it into one of the greatest gold companies in Australia. And then that was just the launching pad for everything else that's happened since.
I am hearing that risk-taking, the willingness to take tremendous risk, was and continues to be a characteristic that is very much a part of you. It is also a trait that is inherent in every successful entrepreneur whom I have met. Sadly, I am also discovering that the willingness to take risk is not automatically passed on to the second, third, or subsequent generations. Talk with us about what risk means to you, and we'd love to know any thoughts you might have on how to cultivate that sense of adventure and risk in future generations.
I think because of my background in mining and putting mines in a production, risk is all about risk mitigation, looking at every little detail. And if you see an area that's open, you go and define that more and more and more. So you're minimizing the risks. My personal life, I guess the way I thought about risk is maybe climbing a mountain. And I thought, if I lose my hold, am I going to die and crash right back down to the bottom? Or where's the ledge that will save me from killing myself? So yeah, I take risks, but not where I die. And what's the worst that would happen anyway? I mean, we're not climbing, I'm not a mountain climber, but what's the worst that would happen? Pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and you try it again and learn from that experience.
And would you say that your children have acquired that sense of adventure as well?
I think, certainly our oldest son, who's now 31, he's never wanted to work for anybody else because he's always seen me work for myself. And he's really enjoying it as his life. The second one, who's 28, he's a bit of a brainiac, and he's not yet found his place because he doesn't want to work for other people either. But he hasn't found yet where or what he can do on his own. So, yeah, I don't think they don't consider risk. Not at all.
If there are three top qualities that you think an entrepreneur should have, or that you would want to instill in your children or other young adults to be successful in life, what would those three or five qualities be?
Well, maybe we're going to get into this when I talk about this charitable organization I created, the Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. So by studying this, there are a lot of things common to a lot of people who, and I've never wanted to call myself an entrepreneur, you just do what you do. But the main thing is having, to me, is a passion, an absolute passion to do what you've set out to do, not to get locked into one end result, to be able to move and change course as and when. With passion comes perseverance. And one of the key things, if I harp back to my mother, is to make your choices in life, not to live to the voices that are in your head from parents or relations or teachers or other people. You should or shouldn't do this. Make your own choice.
In families of wealth, we often speak in terms of generations. As you know, there is a globally recognized parable known as shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. In Asia, it's referred to as rice paddy to rice paddy. In northern England, it's clogs to clogs. The parable goes something like this. Generation one rolls up its shirt sleeves and goes to work. As the wealth grows, generation one begins to lavish upon its children the best that money can buy. The second generation goes to the finest colleges. They enjoy luxurious travel and a much higher standard of living than that of their parents. By generation three, this generation often has not developed a very strong work ethic and consequently spends all the money. And by the end of the third generation, their offspring are rolling up their sleeves and beginning again. You have an interesting and empowering belief that each generation should always consider themselves the first generation. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, this is different for me, but part of the reason for us engaging with you, Ginny, is that I was certainly aware, even before the dollar started flowing, about the sandals to sandals and shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves. And I thought, well, I don't want that to happen. And so we're working more with our sons. And even though they're not involved in my business, I don't really have a business for them to be involved in. But they're directors, and we have regular directors meetings, and they're more involved with our foundation. I think as we're moving along in life, I've realized that it's just crazy to think about first, second, third, multiple generations, we're fifth generation, whatever. I mean, we're all umpteenth generations from wherever our ancestors come from. But that's not what drives us. So I believe every generation should consider themselves the first generation and not a maintainer of the wealth. I don't want to force that upon our sons, that their job is to look after the wealth that I've created. I'd rather them go and do their own thing. Mm-hmm. And whether we give all our money away or whatever, or they use it for some good or use it to build their own lives with.
So when you came to me, and as it became clearer to you and your family that you had become wealthy, and actually, before I even go there, let's talk about this. At one time, I shared with you that I often, in my work, am not even sure how to refer to the population of people who are wealthy. Are they families of wealth? Are they just rich people? Are they all one percenters? I mean, all of it can feel definitive and almost judgmental at some level. So let's talk a little bit about how do you like to be referred to as that population?
Well, I don't like being classed in any form or manner. Yes, we do have wealth. There are many, many, many people way, way wealthier than us. It's what you do with it. I think that makes a difference, not how you refer to yourself. I hated it. And my wish came true several years ago. There was a business magazine, an Australian national business magazine, and I was in whatever their top 100 or whatever. And all these, and the newspapers, and people I didn't even know, and my son's friends and things came and said, "Whoa, look what you're worth, and look at this, and look at that." And it did more damage to us. And I thought, I wish I was never. I called the magazine. I said, "I don't want to be there next. Leave me out." No. "We have to have you in." I didn't want that notoriety. I don't think it does anybody any good. So we try to fly under the radar and keep it quiet and do our own lives and not. And yes, we have a nice place here and nice places where we live and we travel and all that, but it's relative to what we have, we don't spend an awful lot.
You're listening to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information, visit our website, dynamicsoffamilywealth.com. And now back to the show.
So, how did you begin to start educating your family about the family wealth, the family money? How did you decide to do it? And how did you communicate to them what money means to you and what you hoped for them? And I'm curious about what things did you want them to learn and what things did you want to learn from them in these conversations with them about the family wealth?
It was hard when they were younger, in their early teens, to start having that conversation, mostly because they were very demonstrative to us about being embarrassed when their friends are, and I wouldn't have even said their friend, people that they knew or they were in school with, and they said, "Oh, you're so wealthy, you could do this and that, and your father..." And they were embarrassed by it. And I thought, how do we overcome this? And there are no right or wrong answers, but I started reading a lot of books. And then coming here to Aspen pretty regularly is when we met you. And I started realizing and especially as the boys got older, how to start having those conversations. And if it wasn't for our family, if you want to call it family retreat, that we did here with you, I think that's one of the best things that's ever happened to us.
So tell me more about that family retreat. Like, what was it that you and your family gained from that experience? And what did your family really, what do you think happened that was so transformational for you and your family in that retreat?
I think the retreat gave us an in-depth understanding of what the four of us, myself and my wife and the two boys, what we were all about. And the two boys, they didn't understand one another. They were polar opposites, socially, mentally, in every manner. When you're day to day, you just talk about little bits and pieces that are happening in your life, little snippets, but you don't get down to the true meaning of what you are as a person. You helped us distill in each of us what we truly believe and what we truly want for each other. And then we express that to each other. We came together as a family and say, what are the core values as a family do we believe in? And we really engaged with that and talked about it and wrote them up and actually designed a, if you want to call it a logo, that has been with us ever since.
I think that the family vision statement that you all came up with is so unique and powerful. Because I've, as you can imagine, I've worked with a lot of different families, and surprisingly, no family has the same vision, family vision and family mission statement. So if you would share with our audience what that vision statement is and how it's been translated into your family beautiful piece of artwork logo.
Well, I think the simplest statement is that our legacy is greater than us. And that goes hand in hand with saying every generation is the first generation, is what that instills. And the four pillars of what we, I guess, believe in is family, and that family is first. The other pillar is our social side of life, our friends, and how we deal with the rest of the world. Our desire for education, for intellectual stimulation, to the pursuit of knowledge, I guess, is what it boils down to, pursuit of knowledge. And the last one is about monetary wealth. So that's only one of four pillars of, I think, what we have as a family.
So what do your family meetings look like now as a result of the retreat?
I think really each and everything has strengthened. The CERI, the Center for Entrepreneurial Research and Innovation, I've referred to with the blessing of the boys. And this, a lot of their inheritance is being spent, a huge amount, on this center. And they back it 110%. It's the best thing I've ever done. And I couldn't understand, I got to say something about, not so much about CERI, but about giving. Our foundation was, for years, has been about education for disadvantaged children, especially those from the country that don't have the facilities that people living in the city have. And that's well and good, and we still do that. But CERI, we're dealing with, this is all about enabling PhDs, researchers, postdocs from across our universities and research institutes to be able to move their research out of the labs and into the real world. As much as the universities say and look and whatever we're doing, they don't know how to do it. They're not entrepreneurial at all. And these are people that, they are solving problems, but they've never been given a pathway to understand or self-empowerment out of academia, how to move these things forward. And it just gives me chills. It's so exciting dealing with these people. And I haven't realized until I read something that when you give to others with no expectation of return, it drives endorphins. And endorphins make you feel really, really good.
So that is your legacy, isn't it? Would you say that is, Siri, is the legacy?
In a great part, I hope it is. Where we live in Perth, Western Australia, it is a place that has what you would call a resource curse. It's so endowed, predominantly in iron ore and oil and gas, that governments and the people and flow-on jobs and everything else is so bogged down in resources. And yet we have so many other things that we could develop and drive. We're not doing it because we just keep eating that golden goose of resources. And I recognize that these other areas, these other huge industries that could be driven are going to come from high knowledge, high value industries that are these PhDs and postdocs and whatever out of the universities. And so, yes, this isn't going to happen in a day. This is multi-generational that I'm looking at doing. It won't happen until I'm dead and gone, but at least it's a start.
You know, so one thing I did want to talk with you about is values. You have used the value exercise I did with your family, with your students at Siri. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, this is interesting. Ginny came out to Australia through a group I belong to called the Private Wealth Network. And it's not about how to make wealth or how to save taxes or any. It's about the heart and how we deal with generations. Anyway, Ginny finally came out and she traveled around Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, Auckland, I don't know where else. And she had this exercise where she put up about 50 different values. And you would tick your top five. And the group got up and they all gave a tick next to what their five values were. And it was interesting, in Perth, almost everybody had family and empathy and compassion, things like that, soft values. Yet places like Melbourne, which had a lot more dollars, they were more into arts and things and all that, they were the hard stuff. They were about success and these hard values, which to me didn't reflect your person at all. Anyway, I adopted this for the classes, our entrepreneurship classes that we give, because entrepreneurship is not a single, it's a team. And so many teams are put together just spur of the moment and they fall apart. Generally, the more successful you get, the more likely that team falls apart. So we give them these values exercises to say, what are your core, your common values? So you're relaxed from day one about who it is you're working with. And then we do work that Ginny also had work values. So we do the work values as well. But they all want the same thing that way. But it's interesting, each and every time we do the values thing, like the difference between the cities, our groups are different. And what we're 20 to 25, and every one of them has their top two or three are different from the groups pre or post them.
Right. You know, it has been fascinating for me doing this work with families and family businesses. And invariably, a couple, for instance, or the parents will come in and say, oh, we know what our values are, and they're the same. And then we do this, and they are, quite honestly, flabbergasted to discover how different their values are, and it really does form a real basis for communication and understanding and actually growth for the family. So last thing, words of wisdom. You know, one of the things I like to leave with everybody on my podcast is something that they can do, something they can take away and do themselves without having to hire a consultant, for instance, to come work with the family. But what if you were to put out one thought or action item that everyone could go home and do either with their business or with their family or even with themselves? What would be one action item?
Well, you asked for wisdom, and I don't consider myself wise. To me, it's just strip everything back to understanding your core self. You have to understand yourself first and what it is you really, really want out of life. Not what you think you look like to other people, but what you are to yourself. And I guess I have a strong affinity for nature, doing what I do, and the best place to do that is not in your office, not in your home, not in your car. Just get out in the quietude and sit there and contemplate and just think about what it is that makes you tick and what can you do to drive to improve those good things, strengthen those good things.
Thank you very much. Very powerful and meaningful. And for all of our listeners, we look forward to being with you again during our next podcast. Until then.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information on this podcast or guidance for having more meaningful conversations around inherited or sudden wealth, please visit our website at dynamicsoffamilywealth.com.